Thank you for joining us for Dialogue Out Loud podcast. My name is Teresa Wellborn, Dialogue's poetry editor. Founded in 1966, Dialogue is the oldest independent journal of Mormonism, publishing scholarship, poetry, art, and fiction on the Latter-day Saint experience. Today, we are in conversation with Charles Inouye, and we are so looking forward to conversation with him. Charles' work speaks volumes. He is a very accomplished poet. He hails from the lovely town of Gunnison, Utah, San Pete County. And he is not only an author, but also editor and translator of various works. He is a professor of Japanese literature and visual culture at Tufts. And his research and areas of interest include pre-modern and modern Japanese literature, as well as Gothic studies, realism, lyricism, animism, and eschatology. His work includes, most recently, Hymns of Silence, published last October, which is a short story collection about growing up in the silence of central Utah. Prior to that, Zion, Earth, Zen, Sky, a 2021 autobiography, which I happen to have. There's that. His other work includes Evanescence in Form, an Introduction to Japanese Culture. That was from 2007. Japanese Gothic Tales, he was a translator for that work. In 2017, he was the editor for a Tokyo anthology, Literature from Japan's Modern Metropolis, as well as the author of The Similitude of Blossoms, a critical biography of Izumi Kyoka.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay. As I was reading Charles, his poem, Nantucket Sound, some other poets came to mind. Dylan Thomas came to mind, for example, how he speaks of death having no dominion, as well as other poets, T.S. Eliot, Emily Dickinson, Rilke, William Stafford, and others. They are all poets who touch on themes of death. So let's see, by way of beginning our questioning here, our interview, tell us about your experience, Charles, your exploration of the intersection of Mormonism and Japanese culture, and how that influences you as a writer.
Okay, so that's a great question. I am the youngest son of a family of people who ended up in Utah because of the war, actually. After Pearl Harbor, my father's family and my mother's family were both ended up in the same internment camp in Wyoming. And after that experience, they decided not to go back to California, but to go to somewhere where they could pretty much be alone. And so...
Utah.
Yeah, they ended up in deepest, darkest Utah, and we actually lived in a farmhouse that was a mile from our nearest neighbor, and down the road in Sigurd, Utah, was a town of about 200 people on a good day, most of them gypsum mine workers or farmers, ranchers, and all the white people were Latter-day Saints. My parents were Pure Land Buddhists, and my grandfather was as well. He lived with us during all the time. My mother's mother lived with us in the summer. So they spoke Japanese. My parents didn't want the children to learn Japanese because, you know, it was one of the reasons why they ended up in prison.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they wanted to be, you know, they want us to be monolingual Americans. And of course, as soon as I got a chance to, I rebelled and learned Japanese in college at BYU, in fact.
For you.
I signed up. Bruce Beeman was my teacher. But I wanted to learn Japanese for one particular reason. During my years of growing up on the farm, my closest companion was my grandfather. And he his job was just to make sure that I didn't get into trouble. And we had a pretty much silent relationship. He spoke rarely to anybody, but when he did, it was in Japanese. And to me, he only had a few words. When he said "shinbun," it meant go to the post office and get my newspaper. A few other words, but he spent most of his time with his eyes closed, either sitting or standing. And people would tell me that he was asleep, but I knew that he wasn't sleeping. I could tell that he was thinking about something. All those years, he was thinking about something so absorbing that he couldn't stop thinking about it. And so I wanted so badly to understand what it was, to ask him, you know, all that time we were together, what was it that you were thinking about? So I went to BYU. I studied how to, you know, the very fundamentals of Japanese. I went home for winter break. I found my grandfather sitting by the stove, you know, and I approached him and I greeted him in Japanese. Oji-chan, o-genki desu ka, you know. And he didn't answer. So I tried something else and he didn't answer. I tried something else and he didn't answer. And it turned out that he never did answer. I went off on my mission. While I was there, he passed away. So I never really had the time to have the conversation that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I started to do research about him. And I talked to all my dad's siblings, and my mother's mother knew a lot about him as well. And I got all this information about him. And I discovered that he spoke fluent English. He did. He was famous for it, in fact. So when people in the Bay Area got in trouble with the white people, then they would come to him and he would, you know, mediate for them.
Wow.
But when they threw his family in prison, it made him so angry that he decided that he would never speak English again. So that kind of explains why he didn't speak to me in English, but it doesn't explain why he never spoke to me in Japanese when I learned Japanese. Mm-hmm. In other words, there was a reason why he never spoke to me. And he died before I could figure out what exactly that was.
Wow.
Yeah.
That feels like a profound life enigma, you know, to.
Exactly. Yeah. But strangely enough, last year, so I am the chair of this department at Tufts, which is home to both the Arabic and the Hebrew programs. And so I pretty much had to check in with everyone, you know, on a regular basis just to see how they were doing. I wanted to make sure that whatever happened, we didn't have a big fight, you know, and sort of betray our job description as being a department that can talk about difficult cultural issues and make sense. But as I was, I don't know, somehow I got onto the topic of my grandfather. And as I was talking to my friend Suhad, who is from Palestine, she said immediately, "Oh, I know why your grandfather didn't talk to you." And I says, you know why? Why? He says, "Well, obviously he was trying to protect you. He didn't want you to have the weight of his own history because you needed the ability to grow up on your own, to be ignorant of that mess and sort of gain your confidence. And having, if you had heard all the bad things that had happened to your family, it might have, you know, kind of warped your vision of the world and so forth." So that kind of silence actually helped me. It made me more it made me more optimistic, I guess.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
But I grew up in the church because, to get back to the story, one day the wind blew dust into our valley from Nevada. It contained radioactive particles. And my sister Charlotte, she got leukemia because of that and died of blood cancer. The bishop of the Sickard Ward went to my family, went to my parents and said that he would like to offer the use of the building for her funeral.
Oh,
yeah. And so, you know, they didn't have any other way to kind of deal with that. And so they had a funeral in the Mormon church. Whether it was a Mormon funeral or not, I'm not sure. But my mother said to me that at that funeral, she felt the spirit so strongly that she knew that someday she would probably join the church.
Oh, wow.
But she didn't for many, many years, not until I was on my mission, more than 20 years later, in deference to my grandfather. But what they did do was they would throw us in the station wagon and drive into town on Sunday, drop us off, and then come back 2 hours later and pick us up. So we just grew up within the church. They didn't think that we would take to it, but we did. You know, we're all active members of the church. So it's kind of a surprising development, actually. They were afraid that if we took Mormonism too seriously, we would forget our Japanese-ness, sort of lose our contact with Japan. But what happened was just the opposite. We all went to Japan on missions.
Oh.
We all learned Japanese. And it made us closer to our tradition than farther away from it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you incorporate any Buddhism practices into your life?
Absolutely. I have a Buddhist altar in my house that I inherited from my family. I'm the only one in my family who wanted it. And I actually wanted it very much because one of the things that my grandfather did do one day when I was about 3 years old, a storm came in and he took me into his bedroom. And he set me on top of a chair that he put in front of his dresser. And on top of the dresser was this Buddhist altar.
Hmm.
And he put two sticks of incense in the burner and he lit them with a match. He put a rosary on my hand and he looked into the altar and pointed to this black and white picture. And in this picture was a photo of a woman that I didn't know. About that woman is my grandmother, Mikano, Mikano Inoue, and she, I think that she is probably what my grandfather was thinking about all this time, thinking about her, thinking about the question, did I love her? Did she love me? And the reason why that's an unusual question is because for people of my grandfather's generation, falling in love was just not what you did. It just didn't happen. But because of the situation being, they were in Hawaii when they met, and they came together under very unusual circumstances. Such that you could, you know, you might say that it was a marriage of convenience, economic, you know, necessity or whatever.
Sure.
But I've, you know, been asking around and I think that my grandfather, for being an old, samurai, I think that he actually loved my grandmother. He was way ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. In that he had this romantic relationship with this woman who, like him, had left Japan. She had been married. Her family had, her marriage had been dissolved by her parents, who didn't like the man that she married. She got so depressed that they sent her to Hawaii for on a vacation.
Uh-huh.
It was the last 2 weeks. But she got so sick, depressed, that they thought she might die.
Oh, geez.
So they sent her to Hawaii, and she happened to meet my grandfather, who was there. And then rather than go back home after 2 weeks, she stayed in Hawaii.
Interesting.
Go ahead.
You had shared, and they were Pearl Harbor happened, and then they were interred, sent to California? No, Wyoming.
Heart Mountain, yeah. But by that time she had died, though. She died a month before they were scheduled to go back to Japan. So she never met her parents once she left Japan.
Wow.
Yeah. It, and she left Japan in order to make lots of money and prove to them that she had made a good decision by marrying my grandfather. But at the time was good for not, you know, he was a plantation worker.
Wow. He loved her though, right?
I think so. I think he actually did.
Hmm. Cool. Yeah. I love that you shared some history, some rich, very fascinating to me history of not just of you, yourself, but then of, you know, your grandparents and their journey in life. And there's a quote by Edmund Jabez that comes to mind about silence, which I guess speaks more to perhaps your grandfather, I don't want to say reluctance, but his choice to not respond.
Yeah.
Which anyway, the quote reads, "You do not go to the desert to find identity, but to lose it, to lose your personality, to be anonymous. You make yourself void. You become silence. You become more silent than the silence around you. And then something extraordinary happens. You hear silence speak."
Yeah.
I like to see the interplay of when I read a poet and then I find other poets that kind of speak to me, right? It's like a poetic language. So,
yeah.
Well, this is wonderful. Do you mind if we move on to your lovely poem, Nantucket Sound?
Sure.
Lovely. Okay. First of all, I just want to say this poem really spoke to me. Notes of grief, death of a mother, not leaving us hanging either, because there's the aftermath portion that I felt resonated as well. The portion that really stood out to me, the stanzas, "Dear God in heaven, I fear you've made a world too beautiful for me to understand." I love that. Dang it, that's beautiful. I saw some Christ symbolism, fisher of men, sacrament symbolism, right, in section 3. Do you mind, though, if we jump to section 5?
Sure.
And, have you share with us, read that for us.
Okay. "On my fingers, the salt water feels slippery. A diluted runoff of blood and tears. Black-winged terns skim above the flowing tide, sand eels in the surf. In this cicada shell world, there is no catch and release, only the slashing knife and bleeding out in the live well. Sashimi scup and chunks of bass fried in hot oil. Seeking, finding, crying, Mongo Sanda, I eat and live."
Beautiful. So would you like to tell us a little bit about the poem?
Yeah, well, like lots of things, you know, it started out being something and it took on a life of its own and became something else. But what it was to start with was a simple recounting of a fishing trip. You know, I have a friend who lives on Cape Cod. She's a retired doctor, and she loves to fish, but her husband doesn't like to fish much. So she's always, you know, wanting me to come down and go out with her. So we usually drive down at night and sleep over, and then we get up really early in the morning and go out fishing. So the poem is about that experience of, you know, going and fishing, essentially. But as I wrote it, all these other things kind of crept in, and I remembered my recently deceased brother Dwight, who died of COVID. You know, I remembered my mother who passed away, and how we put her on this dolly sort of thing, gurney, and paused to take a sheet off of her and take her rings off so that we could give them to my sister Annie, and so on. So as I wrote the poem, the strength of the water and the strength of the birds and the fish, the life that they possessed, all registered with me, along with the danger of being out there, you know, on the ocean. The danger of for the fish being caught, the need that we have for them to die so that we can live, and then the connection there with our Savior and his willingness to sacrifice himself. So all those things sort of folded into the poem as it folded into the larger frame of the fishing trip that, you know, takes you away down the river, out into the sea, and then back up the river to where you started. So it's kind of a T.S. Eliot,
yeah,
going back home thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's beautiful. Some of the sections as well, in addition to section 5, section 2, I haven't gotten over the people I've lost. Beautiful. And then another one was section 6, I love how you, the line breaks are just really lovely because you're tripping down the page, much like, you know, movement of water, right? The ancient current returns and waits for the day I walk on water. So beautiful. And I believe your response was, yeah, surely that day will come, but not now. I felt with Rye, like, I love when I see a little, and then the next, and maybe not tomorrow. Anyway, I love when I see little glimpses of humor, you know? Oh, the older I get, the more humor really resonates with me. So I found that it brought a smile. So thank you so much. Well, those are all the questions I have. Did you want to speak to anything else thematically or otherwise, Charles? About the poem, or we can expand that to life in general? Silent.
Well, water. Here's the deal. You know, I love to hunt. It was what I became attracted to at a very young age, and I've remained sort of, you know, without really understanding the meaning of it. I've always wanted to be a hunter, and in that dream of hunting compelled me at a certain point to get a hunting dog. So I have this hunting dog, and he's just right there. His breed is called Small Munsterlander, and he's Northern German hunting dog that is kind of two dogs in one. He's a very calm house dog, but as a hunting dog, he's he's so he's very aggressive and strong, such that if you don't hunt, the breeders of these animals won't sell you this kind of dog.
Oh, uh-huh.
They need to be out and about all the time. So this, my dog has been going to dog school now for 3 years every Saturday morning. I used to make fun of my sister-in-law, Jeannie, for taking her kids all the way from Gunnison to Provo for piano lessons, you know.
Right.
What an extravagant thing to do. And now here I am. I go an hour and a half each way for my dog's lessons. But anyway, why am I telling you this? So
hunting
on opening day this year, it's November the 2nd. It's the first Saturday of November always. And it's always been this wonderful day, you know. And so I'm going to come to Utah with my doggie. And I made him a service animal so that he can ride in coach with me.
Happy. Clever.
But realizing that I was trying to make as much, get as much mileage out of the trip as possible. So I'm going to be giving a talk at the University of Utah on the 30th.
Okay.
One at BYU on the 31st, and then one at Snow College. I'm going to be reading from my book, Hymns of Silence.
Nice.
On the 31st, and then we're going to go hunting on the 2nd, I guess, is the 1st and the 2nd.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's my plug, if people want.
And the cover, how did the cover come about for that?
Hymns of Silence?
It looks like the Mormon LDS hymn book.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So we copied the cover and then changed the organ to aspen trees.
Uh-huh, clever. A nod to Pando, maybe?
What's that?
Do you know about Pando, one of the largest, heaviest?
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course, yeah.
South of S&P County.
Yeah. Wow. But we're getting a hymn book now, so I guess.
Right. Things keep evolving, don't they, in life?
Yeah.
Well, I just want to warmly thank you for your time with us. In closing, in closing, there is a very brief poem that I found that I felt spoke as poet speaks to poet, poem speaks to poem. It's by Dorothea Grossman for Allen Ginsberg. Among other things, thanks for explaining how the generous death of old trees forms the red powdered floor of the forest. So similarly, Charles, we want to thank you for explaining and helping us understand further, the gospel, Jesus Christ, life and death, water and silence. Thank you so much, Charles.
You're very welcome.
Thank you all for listening tonight. Please share this podcast with a friend and check out our entire lineup of excellent podcasts in the Dialogue Podcast Network by visiting dialoguejournal.com. Dialogue Out Loud is produced and edited by Daniel Foster Smith, and our executive producers are Emily Jensen and Taylor Petrie. See you next time. Thanks.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons, Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.